We are ready now for argument in the case of the people of the state of Colorado versus Bergsrud.
May I please report to counsel? My name is Paul Taylor. I'm a first assistant attorney general in the appellate division of the Colorado Department of Law. I'm here for the people in this particular case. I'll start at the beginning so that everybody is at the same point. This is a murder case, the ending part of which was caught on 911 transcript, caught over the cell phone. The defendant was involved with a woman named Linda Cooper, who was apparently abusive. She moved on to a friend of the defendant's. He didn't like that. He called her at home late one night and told her that a horse had been loose in the field. She went out there with Mr. Yeaman, the new boyfriend, and found the defendant out there. He was dressed in black. He had a pistol. He had loaded clips for his pistol. He had extra boxes of ammunition. According to what the 911 operator heard, the defendant confronted the couple. He was mad, cursed them. He shot Mr. Yeaman 6 times. And Ms. Cooper ran out in the field into the dark, laid down. She thought she was safe. She called the 911 operator, and that's how they got the cell phone screen. She thought the defendant had left when actually he had gone down the road to the field, used his pickup truck to block it, and return. He was checking on, Ms. Cooper was checking on the status of Mr. Yeaman, and she screamed and had come back. You're getting shot. The autopsy report shows that she was shot with the gun, with the pistol being pressed into her body. She was shot maybe 4, maybe 5 times. It was impossible to tell because of through and through wounds. About that time, alerted by the 911 operator, sheriff's deputies arrived. Well, actually, the sheriff's deputies arrived before the shooting. They came up, they told the defendant to drop his weapon. He fired into Ms. Cooper several times. Then he started firing at the sheriff's deputy themselves. They opened fire. I don't believe they hit him. He was wounded once with an apparent gunshot wound. It wasn't clear whether the deputies had shot him or he had shot himself while trying to reload his pistol. Both victims died. The defendant was charged with first-degree murder for the two killings and first-degree assault on a peace officer for shooting at the two sheriff's deputies. This case is a very large appellate record. It started off as a death penalty case because it fell within the from ambush capital aggravating factor. The district attorney decided not to go for death case, and then it became a regular first degree murder case. The defendant's first defense team, they got him a hung jury. That means that the jury could not arrive at a unanimous verdict concerning. So he was tried a second time with a new defense attorney who was going to use the same defense that had procured the defendant a hung jury the first time. And the first defense was that because of the defendant's mental capacity, there was evidence that he was at fairly low levels of intelligence, he was not able to form the requisite mental states for first-degree murder. And the requisite mental state for first-degree murder is person acts intentionally and after deliberation. So what happened was, defense counsel made their opening statement when this defense, or where defense counsel got up and said, we expect evidence to show you, the jury, that the defendant could not form the culpable mental state for first-degree murder. And first-degree assault and peace officer, it's intentional. And then when they were done, the defense counsel tells the trial court, the defendant has something to say to you. And so the defendant got up and said, I don't want my attorneys to present this defense. I want them to argue self-defense. my attorney from my first trial, who's no longer around, told me he wished he'd gone for self-defense, so I want to force my current counsel to go for self-defense. Current defense counsel, I don't think, said anything at all. This is all based on what the defense said. The trial court excused the jury and held a hearing. The trial court explained to the defendant that, or heard what he had to say, he wanted to present self-defense. And the trial court learned that counsel didn't want to present self-defense. And the trial court said, well, that is a call. What technical defense to present, self-defense or things like that, that is a matter for your counsel to decide. It's not for you. And you've got a hard choice. Either go with this defense that your counsel wants to present and which you're not thrilled about, or you can represent yourself. And I'll call the jury back in. You can do the case yourself on your own, and I'll instruct them to ignore it. The defendant said, that's what I want to do. I want self-defense. They don't want to argue self-defense. If you're not going to appoint me new counsel, I want to do it myself. So the defendant went pro se. He testified that he was the victim of two conspiracies that met what he thought was self-defense. First conspiracy was that he didn't lure the victim out there. When he got out there, they attacked him.
Mr. Keller?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Just to interrupt you a little bit here, I think that the defense makes the point that the facts, the ultimate facts, don't really count in determining what the issue is. And I guess what I'd like to hear, what your view is. As I get it, the argument of the defense is that by arguing that he's not guilty of first because there's no mental state, culpable mental state is not satisfied, that he's tentatively or effectively admitting his guilt pretty much in the way that the Kansas case that we've had cited, where the lawyer argued that the guy's not guilty of first-degree intentional murder because it's a life sentence, but he was guilty of felony murder, which is merely a 40-year sentence. There are other issues in that Kansas case, but I wonder what your view is. Do you agree with that?
Yes, and that's what the Court of Appeals held, Your Honor, that not arguing self-defense when the defendant wants it to be argued is tantamount to making a guilty
plea. Do you think that's correct?
No, Your Honor. And there's
if not, why?
Well, there's several reasons. We look at defendants. Everybody knows that defendants have a variety of constitutional rights when they go to trial. Some of those rights, because of their intensely personal nature, because they affect the entire proceeding, must be waived by the defendant in person. There's other extremely important constitutional rights, like the ability to call witnesses, like the ability to cross-examine witnesses, things like that, that counsel exercises on behalf of the defendant, and the defendant doesn't even have to confer with the defendant. The defendant cannot like the way it's being done, but that is what counsel gets to do. And concerning your question about whether this is an implied guilty plea, I think it's been addressed twice in fairly analogous situations. First, by the United States Supreme Court in Florida versus Nixon. And secondly, by this court fairly recently in People versus Gardner. In the Nixon case, it was a death penalty case. And defense counsel got up and said, we're not going to contest. We did not plead guilty, but we're not going to contest the prosecution's evidence here. What we are here before the jury is to show that he should not be sentenced to death.
Can I just break in here just a second?
Oh, sure, yeah.
The difficulty is that's, the Nixon case is a death penalty case, and as you well know, there are very significant considerations that cause a death penalty case to be different. And there, by all accounts, the lawyer was not acting below the proper standard of representation. He wasn't acting unprofessional, right? We have that situation here where I think by everybody agrees that the lawyer wasn't acting unprofessional. Isn't that right?
Was not
acting unprofessional.
Correct. Yeah, well.
So does that make any difference? How do we view that? And that was an ineffective assistance case. This is a case on direct appeal.
death penalty cases are their own weird thing, as the court knows. I've annoyed at the over the years about that. But the language that we're talking about that is important to the people in this particular case is the language in Nixon concerning which are the fundamental constitutional rights over which the defendant has absolute control, and which are the rights for which counsel has the duty to exercise. And the language concerning which rights the defendant has control over, absolute control over, is broad language. It does not just apply to death penalty cases. This court in ARCO, which was a non-death penalty case, addressed whether a trial counsel can impose a lesser included offense instruction against the defendant's wishes, which is somewhat similar. It's what counsel here wanted to do. They wanted to argue guilt on lesser included offenses, not on the top charged offenses. This court, too, using that exact same language from Florida versus Nixon, he said, this is a decision that is entrusted to counsel. It is not a decision, it was not one of those, I think this court said three, I think there's four, probably maybe five, decisions which are entrusted to the defendant and over which the defendant has to decide.
Do you think there's a different, you recall the Court of Appeals attempted to distinguish ARCO? And I'd like to hear what you have to say about that, but let me just put a little gloss on the way I ask a question. Do you think there's a difference between instructing on lesser offenses or requesting that they be instructed on and actually abandoning in front of the jury your client with regard to lesser crimes?
I didn't really understand that part of the Court of Appeals opinion concerning how ARCO supported the decision. I thought it went the opposite way.
How about this idea?
Pardon me?
That ARCO dealt with after the evidence was in and this did.
Well, that could be. The question is this a decision that over which the defendant has absolute right of control, such that he must be allowed to force his counsel to present that? Now, we're not saying that one of the cases that the defendant cites involved a trial court saying, if you don't like what your attorney is doing, just sit down and shut up, and that's what happened. Obviously, that's not what happened. That's not good, and that's not what happened here. The question is, if this is an issue over which the defendant gets a college choice, makes a choice, he gets to force counsel or force the trial court to look around and attempt to procure counsel who will follow the defendant's directions as to this particular defense.
Mr. Kohler, can I just ask a question? I mean, isn't one of these fundamental rights that we're talking about the right to plead guilty or not? And the argument is that the lawyer, the defense lawyer, got up in her opening argument and said, he is guilty, not maybe in so many words, but he is guilty, but not of what he was charged. And so that is, she's taking a guilt-based defense. What the defendant wanted to do is say, I'm not guilty at all. I'm completely innocent. The only reason I shot these people is in self-defense. So we really have to characterize it, as the Court of Appeals did, as a guilt-based defense and an innocence-based defense. Do you agree with that basic organization behind our criminal law?
No, I don't think this court agreed with it in ARCO, or the Supreme Court did in the Florida versus Nixon. It squarely rejected the idea that either lesser included offense or just saying he's guilty, we're going for on the sentencing issues here. That is not the same as a guilty plea, because as both this court and the Supreme Court pointed out, when the defendant goes to trial in this situation, he still maintains all of his various trial rights. He gets to call witnesses, he gets to cross-examination witnesses, he's got his rights to appeal, he's got his right to effective assistance of counsel, he has a right that the verdicts be supported by sufficient evidence. If a defendant was actually forced to plead guilty by counsel, those would all disappear, mostly all would completely disappear.
But he's being forced. The defendant will make this argument more strongly, but if I understand his position, he's being forced in this particular trial to say, I am guilty of something, which is tantamount to a guilty plea, at least according to the Court of Appeals.
Yes, going back, I think this court and the Supreme Court have rejected that. And when we talk about various technical defenses like self-defense here, sorry, that's what we call a plea, or it's akin to what we call a key of confession avoidance, saying, I did this, I did these acts, but I was legally privileged to act as I did. So they're somewhat similar in that.
Help me out with this. Did the defense counsel in the second trial ask for a self-defense instruction or not?
No, it was short-circuited. And that's one of the things the trial court tried to explain to the defendants, because this situation happened at the close of opening statements, where defense counsel got up and said, we expect the evidence to show that the defendant was informed of the mental state. And then the defendant said, I don't want that, I want self-defense. And the trial court explained, well, that doesn't limit what your counsel is going to do at the end of the case, because if the evidence showed that you acted in self-defense, your counsel can request a self-defense instruction, and the jury can hear that.
Well,
the defense said, my attorneys told me they're not going to go with self-defense.
Okay, well, the law of getting the self-defense instruction requires some evidence. Right. Not a great deal, but some indication in the facts.
Yeah.
Now,
more than scintilla of evidence is each single right. element.
When the defendant decided to represent himself, did he ask the judge for an instruction?
He asked for and received self-defense instruction.
He did get it.
He got them, and the jury rejected it.
Okay.
And in sentencing, quoted in our brief, the trial court said, I listened to the evidence, and I find that your self-defense claim was credible and preposterous, which are fairly strong findings.
Let me
Mr.
ask.
Mr. Taylor?
Okay.
I'm sorry. You or me?
Let me go ahead.
Go ahead, okay. Sir.
I'm just going to follow up about the defendant. Then, so the defendant testified, as you've said. Let me ask you a question. You addressed Justice Rice about a plea of guilty, but in addition, you've conceded, and it's clearly the case, that the defendant has a right to testify without regard to what his counsel wants. Would it be ineffective? Would he have a challenge to his counsel if his counsel were to contradict his testimony before the jury? Does that tantamount to what's happened here with the opening statement?
It's a hard call to make, because it's pretty impossible to show. A defense attorney can get up and say, we've heard evidence of self-defense, and can argue it in a very reduced fashion, and then say, but our main argument is that the defendant could not form the public mental state. Just because, just because an attorney presents an argument doesn't even mean that he's presenting it forcefully. And he can present it as saying, this is our first argument, but if you don't buy that argument, here's a really good argument. And that's what could happen. And I guess that's what could happen if this court were to hold that defense attorneys must take direction from their clients as to what technical defense.
But in reality, it's totally inconsistent. I mean, that's the problem with this case. It's totally inconsistent to say, I shot them, but I didn't have the right intent when I shot them, versus they attacked me, and so I just responded to it. I acted in self-defense, right?
So
when that was presented to the judge, I mean, that's the way he saw the problem, as being totally inconsistent. Something has to give.
The judge didn't explain too much what he thought, but the defendant said he was the victim of two conspiracies where they tried to attack him, and then the police officers came and shot Ms. Cooper by accident, and then they shot Mr. Yeaman to cover up shooting Ms. Cooper by accident. It was not a very good self-claim. But yeah, oftentimes.
But so here, what I'm doing is now asking about the judge. So he was put in this position of the defendant saying, no, this is what I want, and defense counsel already having made this opposite sort of opening argument. And so then the judge said to the defendant, well, you are going to have to pick. Either go with what your defense counsel said or represent yourself.
That's
and
right.
Why was that okay? I mean, that...
First of all, everybody knows that defendants have a right to counsel, and you have a right to procure counsel if you want to. And if the defendant had the money, he could have shopped around until he found a defense attorney who was willing to present this argument that could be, from the record, a clear sign of ineffective assistance of counsel. And defense attorneys want to represent their clients zealously, but they don't want to be accused of being ineffective, which could affect their license. They have attorneys, criminal defense attorneys, prosecutors too, we're supposed to represent our clients to the best of our professional abilities, with the best of our, using our experience. And by telling an defense attorney that he or she has to present a defense that he thinks or she thinks is ludicrous, or which will not ultimately result in a jury instruction, that's forcing counsel to act, at least facially, unreasonably.
See, Mr. Cater, you describe it as a difference of strategy, and I don't take issue with your statement that forcing defense counsel to pursue a different strategy is not problematic, that the attorney is the captain of the ship. However, it seems to me what has been explored is, has the attorney admitted something that the defendant denies and therefore has effectively pled guilty? And that's, of course, the argument the defense is making, that this is effectively a guilty plea. You were asked earlier whether the attorney, and we sort of explored the inconsistency of the attorney's no intent and no deliberation versus the self-defense. But what I want to focus you on is, did the attorney actually admit to something over the defendant's objection? And it seems to me that Arco and Nixon were both concerned, at least somewhat, as to whether there was an admission of guilt to something over an affirmative objection by the defendant. Here, the defendant's objection is self-defense. The attorney's statement is no deliberation, no intent. Is the attorney admitting something the defendant is not admitting?
I don't think so. And I think he's even maybe even less, he's admitting even less than what the defendant wants. Because the defendant says, I acted reasonably in killing these people. So he was saying, I was using some sort of reasonable response. And defense counsel was saying he lacked capacity. I haven't, to tell the truth, Your Honor, I haven't reread opening statements in quite a while.
But part of what you're saying then is self-defense is confession and avoidance. So self-defense essentially says, yes, I did the crime, but it should be excused for these additional reasons. The defense attorney is saying he didn't do the crime, he did the act, but he didn't do the crime because of intent. And is that accurate?
I would think so. I haven't reviewed opening statements quite a while, so I can't exactly say what defense counsel said. I think.
But would you say that doesn't matter?
I mean, it seems
to me what you're saying is, If the defense attorney said he's guilty of this crime, that crime, and the other, and our defense is a little different, and the defendant is screaming up and down, no, I'm not, no, I'm not, that's strategy to you.
Yes, sir. And the situation should not have happened.
That goes beyond Nixon, and it also goes beyond Arco, does it not?
I don't think so.
Well, let me just ask you, because I want to follow up on exactly what Justice Martinez is. In the opening statement, the counsel said, basically, there's a difference between somebody who plans a murder and my client, who on his worst day at his worst level of functioning reached his breaking point, loses it, and does something catastrophic that they did not plan, they did not think about, they did not reflect upon. Isn't she saying, I think it's a she, isn't she saying, he did this. He shot these people.
Which is what the defendant is saying. She said she did it. He did it, but he did not meet the elements of the crime for which he was charged. The defendant says, I did it, but I did it intentionally, but I have, I'm legally justified because they were attacking me first.
Can I ask you a different question? In the defense counsel's brief, they distinguish between a defense that they call guilt-based defense and one called innocence-based defense. Do you accept those categories?
I don't really know that. I don't really understand the difference between those two. I guess if the defendant said, I am absolutely guilty. I was in Rio at the carnival. The murder happened in Weld County. I had nothing to do with this at all. That might be one situation. But I think when you get down to the exercise of technical defenses, and there's a bunch of technical defenses, which are based on separate elements and their own bodies of case law and are separate requirements in order to present the various technical defenses, that comes down to, which is what we have here, that comes down to a call by defense counsel because it is based on his or her training and experience. And not on, and it's, I think if we look at the other rights over which the defendant, which everybody acknowledges the defendant has the right, absolute right to control, whether to plead guilty or not guilty, whether to have a jury trial or not have a jury trial, whether to testify or remain silent, or whether to have appeal or not, and probably right to be present is probably hooked in there too. Those are all simple decisions that cover the whole framework of the trial. And everything else, and the defendant has an absolute right to make one of those decisions. If he wants to go to trial, he can. If he doesn't want to go to trial, he doesn't have to. If he wants to have an appeal, he can. If he wants to testify, he can. If he doesn't want to, it's something he can exercise by himself. But when you look at the exercise of the various technical defenses, in our briefs we set out, there's a lot of limitations on it. A defendant can't just come up and say, I want my counsel to present the affirmative defense of self-defense if there's not going to be any evidence on it, if it's based on perjured testimony, if it's based on any of the other limitations that can prevent a defendant from getting an instruction on an affirmative defense.
But Mr. Kidd, is it the same thing to say you can't force the defense attorney to pursue self-defense and then to say, on the other hand, the defense attorney may admit criminal liability for some offenses? Aren't those very distinguishable things?
I don't think so, Your Honor. ARCO, I think, which the court said, defense counsel can impose a lesser included offense instruction over the client's expressed wishes. I think that's pretty much what we have here, except it's done in opening statement and not in the jury's instruction. I think we're dealing with a very analogous situation. I'll save the rest of my time unless the court has any direct questions.
You may.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Eric Samler on behalf of Mr. Berger. I think what we need to start with is knowing what the dispute here actually is. The dispute is not, as the people have framed it, as whether a defendant has a fundamental right to direct counsel to employ a specific defense once the defendant has pled not guilty. The question is much more basic than that. The question is whether an attorney's decision to confess in opening statements the defendant's guilt to a crime over a defendant's expressed objections, and then go one step further, as it was done here, tell the jury that the defendant is not a credible witness because he doesn't know what happened, or he convinced himself that something else happened, usurps the defendant's right to control the objective of the representation. So when we talk about guilt-based defenses and innocent-based defenses, we need to look at what the objective of the representation is. The objective of the representation here that Mr. Berger wanted was an acquittal. What the objective that the attorney tried to employ in opening statements was not an outright acquittal, but was a conviction of a lesser offense. The question then becomes also whether if the attorney insists upon pursuing that course of action when the defendant has made the objection to that course of action known.
So you're not asking us for a very broad rule. You're just looking at your client's case here.
Well, of course I'm just looking at my client's case first. That's what I represent. But I think the rule is pretty basic. I think the rule is whether or not, who controls the objective of the representation. We know who steers the ship. That's clear.
See, I'm not understanding that, because what you just said was the opening statement from the get-go basically contained some kind of admission.
Well, it did contain some kind of...
Okay, but that is different from what you just suggested, seems to me, about who controls the case. I mean, you know, your client, I think you admit, you know, can't force the counsel to fabricate evidence, right? We know that.
Of course not. Of course not.
So if a client says, no, I want you to take the position that in your opening statement that the facts are as follows.
No, counsel cannot do that.
Okay.
We're not asking for that. I'm not asking for that. I think the line's much more brighter one than that. The question is whether in opening statements counsel can admit client's guilt to a crime, which is exactly what happened here, and then go one step further and usurp the client's ability to even testify by telling the jury that the client's not a credible witness.
Okay. Should she have said, my client takes the position in this case that this is a case of self-defense?
She didn't need to do that. We're not asking that she needed to do that in this case.
Well, that's what he wanted.
Well, that's what he wanted, but the attorney did not need to go forward with the self-defense claim.
So you can ignore your client if you do exactly what the client wants, which is to say, argue this as self-defense.
The attorney did not need to necessarily argue this as self-defense if there was not evidence to support it. If it was based on perjured testimony, we already have that rule in effect. If there was not going to be any evidence to support the giving of an instruction.
What should the attorney have done in your view? Should the attorney just have skipped opening statement and just passed on opening statement?
Perhaps.
For starters?
I think what is much more basic. I think the fact that this dispute was happening was known to counsel.
Yes.
Way before. It was known months before that there was this dispute of whether or not to go with this defense that he committed the crime and we're going to try to get second-degree murder or manslaughter rather than first-degree murder. I think that's a distinguishing factor, too, between the first trial and the second trial, because no lesser includes were asked for in the first trial. So the attorney should have gone to the court and said, we have this dispute. This is what's going on, Your Honor. Just as they did in the supplement that I presented to the court in the book, this is what happens all the time, is this is what's going on. We need to determine whether or not there's a conflict between counsel.
I'm not sure what you said in your last remark. Did you mean to say that this is the kind of thing that happens all the time?
Well,
I thought that's what I heard you.
It happens all the time as far as who gets to control the defense. Oftentimes there were situations where a defendant will say, my attorney's not listening to me, I want to go X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
He files a motion for a new attorney, which actually did not happen here, or the attorney files a motion saying, I want to withdraw because there's an irreconcilable conflict. There's a hearing before the judge, and the judge says, hey, the attorney gets to choose this defense or that defense, and things are made clear. And I think if that had happened here, what had happened, especially if this court gives some guidance, that the attorney gets to choose specific defenses to employ. All of the defenses that the people have laid out in their opening brief and in the reply brief all have one thing in common. They are all defenses that seek an acquittal. They're all defenses that, if are successful, will result in an acquittal or in a finding of innocence. That's not so in this situation when an attorney is admitting in opening statements that his client committed a crime.
So your point is that the attorney makes the strategic choices led up to a point, and the point is, if the defendant wants to pursue a defense which could lead to an innocence determination, to a not guilty determination,
mm-hmm.
and the defense attorney does not, then that crosses a line, and that's not strategy.
It crosses the line if it's done so in open statements, and I think that's a bright line rule. Because if after
pursuing so if it's done the, so later, if it's done later in the case, it doesn't cross the line?
Yeah, I think it does not. Because if after pursuing, because in opening statements, we have to remember that there has been no evidence presented at that point. No evidence has come out whatsoever at all. So if after pursuing the defendant's expressive objective to obtain a not guilty verdict, the evidence that comes there is such that the best strategy
might be. So what you're saying is the defense attorney has to follow the defendant's strategy until it doesn't work and then can switch strategies.
I don't think it's a switching of strategies because the attorney is still free to argue for outright acquittal. As this court said in ARCO, when you put in a lesser non-included, you can still argue for an outright acquittal. But when you get up there in opening statements and say, hey, my client's guilty of at least second-degree murder, maybe manslaughter, how can the attorney go out there in closing arguments and argue for outright acquittal?
Well, it's not possible. You are saying, if I understand this right, if the defense attorney had waived opening statements, chose not to make one, which he doesn't have to, and his statements aren't evidence, as we all know. And at the end of the case, he argued not self-defense, but the strategy no intent, no deliberation. There'd be nothing wrong in that scenario, even though the defendant made it clear to the court he wanted self-defense.
Well, I'm not sure we need to go that far, because you can make in closing arguments, you can give the jury numerous different options. You can say, but the client's not guilty.
But Mr. Samler, you sort of projected that because you were trying to tell me that there's a major distinction about whether it's said in opening statement. It seems to me from your brief that the reason that you focus that way is because you've characterized the opening statement here as a judicial admission. I'm not sure it operates in that way. Could you explain?
Even if it's not a judicial admission, that was just an example, and I'm not saying it necessarily does, but What it does is tells the jury in no uncertain terms that my client has committed a crime. And that's exactly what happened here. So Mr. Bergerud committed a crime. It's up to you to determine.
Okay, Sam, does it, if I may just one follow-up question there. Does it matter, I mean, perhaps that's correct, or at least that's the implication of what he said. However, it is also true, I believe, you can comment, but he didn't admit anything that the defendant wasn't admitting by self-defense. Does that matter?
Well, I think it does, and I think it puts the cart before the horse. I think what we're here on is not necessarily whether in this particular situation an attorney can do that. The question is whether or not an attorney can impose a guilt-based defense. And by that, I mean a defense that necessarily results in a finding of guilt of a crime. In self-defense, there is that possibility.
So what you are saying is a defense attorney cannot pursue what you're calling a guilt-based defense over the defendant's objection, even if the defendant's desired defense concedes all of the things that the defense attorney is conceding by pursuing that defense.
If counsel does not believe that's the best strategy, I agree with that counsel does not necessarily have to take that route. Counsel here did not need to go forward with self-defense. I'm not arguing that they did have to go forward with the defense of self-defense. What I'm arguing is that counsel cannot, in opening statements, concede guilt to a crime. That's the only question we're here on, is whether or not counsel in opening statements can concede guilt in a crime, and then even, as was done here, go one step further, saying, telling the jury, don't believe what my client testifies to because he doesn't know what happened. And if he does know what happened, he's convinced himself that something else happened. He's just deluded.
Mr. Sandler, it just seems to me that your argument assumes a little too much on the impact of opening statements. Certainly there are cases, maybe not this one, where the defense lawyer gives an opening statement and claims one particular defense, and so the defendant wants self-defense. But the facts, as they come out, are more consistent with self-defense than an involuntary intoxication defense. So how do you explain that?
It depends on what the intoxication defense is. If the intoxication defense is the only specific intent crime, that's the only crime that individual is being charged with, then that's still an innocent-based defense. That's still an innocent-based defense. If intoxication is shown,
well, there's also lessers, so that's not particularly
if
murder.
There are lessers,
so that's not
if
really.
If there are lessers going to be introduced, the problem well, that there wasn't in the first trial when they went forward, there was no lessers introduced, and it was agreed that there were no lessers going to be introduced. It was an all or nothing roll of the dice.
Mr. Samler, can I get into this conversation? So let's assume that this conflict, as you perceive it, arose, and the judge said exactly what he did. There's a conflict, but instead of making the defendant go by himself, pro se, he appointed another lawyer. Mm-hmm. And then the next lawyer had exactly the same conflict, because it seems sort of silly, doesn't it, on the facts, to take a self-defense defense. I mean, that could just go on and on and on.
But if that's only presumes that the defendant has the right to choose and employ that specific defense of self-defense, and we're not claiming that he does. All we're claiming is that the counsel cannot throw the client under the bus in opening statements. So, in this case, for example, if another attorney was appointed and counsel was clear that what they can't do is concede guilt or go forward with a strategy, at least in openings, an opening statement, that because of Mr. Berger's mental state, he did not commit the crime of first-degree murder, then that's fine. There wouldn't have been an issue.
There still would have been the issue, because the defendant still would have wanted to have a self-defense.
Well, the defendant doesn't get to make that choice. That sort of situation happens all the time at the district court level and counsels. And at that point in time, as long as the attorney is not going forward, at least in opening statements, or trying to pursue and not trying to, because the problem here is that there was an objective, the objective representation was finding it wasn't incredible. That's what Mr. Berger would wish to have. How to get there? That's counsel's choice.
Would you answer this for me? It really seems to me, by the time all the facts come out, that the trial judge is absolutely correct. It's preposterous to claim two conspiracies like this. So how in any way was this opening short statement of the defense counsel really prejudicial to your client when the facts itself were enough to show that it would be totally absurd to claim that what he wanted to say?
I don't think the question is one of whether or not it's prejudicial. I don't think it's an issue of prejudice. I think the issue is who gets to make that choice, at least at the beginning of the case, of what the objective of representation is, and whether or not counsel has to listen to what the objective of representation is.
Are you supporting the Court of Appeals opinion, or are you suggesting a modification?
I don't have any problems with modifications of the Court of Appeals decision. Court of Appeals opinion. Perhaps it goes too far, perhaps it doesn't. But
I'd like to know what your position was.
Do I think it's a fundamental right? I don't think the Court of Appeals decision states that the defendant has a fundamental right to choose self-defense. I don't think it says that. I don't think it ever says that. I think what it says is who gets to choose the objective of representation. And if the objective of representation is to seek an acquittal, to get an acquittal, the defendant has the right to seek that objective.
Could I follow up on Justice Hobbs' question about prejudice? Because I'm not sure, and actually it fits into this discussion as well, I'm not sure what kind of an error you see this to be. It seems like from what you're arguing, you're saying the judge should have declared a mistrial and given the guy a new counsel and let him go to a new trial. I'm not following exactly why that should be, and let me just follow up by maybe you could address, and if in effect what this amounts to is some kind of lack of competence or lack of effective representation, would we have to address that in terms of prejudice then as an effective assistance problem?
Well, first of all, this couldn't be an ineffective claim because Mr. Berger didn't have counsel. He went pro se. So this isn't an ineffective assistance to counsel claim. The claim here is a Sixth Amendment denial of the right to counsel. And I think what we need to look at here, and I can actually deal with this in part when I look at the oral argument in Florida v. Nixon, and I think that was referenced in the supplement in the book text that I provide to the court. Because what we have here is an irreconcilable conflict between Mr. Berger and his attorney. And once he was put in the position of saying, okay, you can go forward with this conflicted attorney, or you can go forward with no attorney. And either way, we have a denial of Mr. Berger's Sixth Amendment right to counsel. And I would just like, if I may, go forward with what hypothetical that was put forth in oral argument in Florida v. Nixon by Justice Souter to the U.S. attorney who was acting as amicus. He asked the U.S. attorney, well, if the defendant announced to the trial judge and jury that he disagreed with counsel's decision to concede guilt, what should be done? And the U.S. attorney stated, well, the alternative counsel should be appointed. Justice Souter agreed. Justice Souter then asked counsel whether counsel could possibly render effective assistance under these circumstances. Again, the U.S. attorney stated no, as such a situation would lead to a complete breakdown in the attorney-client.
Mr. Sandler, let me try to tie a couple of things together. Of course, we all know this is not an effective assistance case. Mm-hmm. You said earlier that the defense attorney should not be allowed to throw the defendant under the bus at the onset of the case. Mm-hmm. And I hope I didn't read too much into that, but I sort of took that as an interesting statement of the principle that you're sort of really looking for in this case, because you've tried to distinguish opening from other parts. And it seems to me what you're saying is the defense counsel can't announce this inconsistent strategy at the onset of the case. If that's the principle, then although this is not an ineffective assistance of counsel case, wouldn't that sort of problem be best reviewed in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel? That is, did the attorney throw the client under the bus at the onset of the case, or was that just a very accurate statement of where the evidence is going in this case and not below some standard? Because what Justice Coates was asking you about is the fact that your argument tends to look like it's about counsel performing to some level, as opposed to a principle that seems to be extracted from some principle difference between a innocence defense versus the defense pursuit.
I think they're interrelated. What we have here is the question is who controls the objective of the representation. I mean by that, who gets to choose what the objective of the representation is? And that's by both ethical rule and by the Sixth Amendment, as the court stated in Feretta, as who's the master, who gets to choose the objective.
Mr. Sandler.
That the defendant gets to choose the objective of representation. But how to get there, that's the attorney's choice. So, for example, if in this situation, what should have happened, in my opinion, perhaps a cookie cutter, what I call a cookie cutter opening statement should have been given. We'll let you hear the evidence, you make your decision at the end. And then once the evidence comes out, then what you can do is, at the end, argue for lesser culpability by offering a lesser. You can, or lesser not included, you can tailor closing arguments to what the evidence presented was, the inferences that can be drawn from that evidence. And you can even argue for outright acquittal, saying that Mr. Berger didn't do this, but if he did, we ask that you find X, Y, and Z. But what happens here is that all those other things, the outright acquittal can't happen. So what we're saying is even if the attorney thinks that the objective can't be met, there's no way in God's green earth the objective can be met, I don't have to follow that objective. And I don't think that's right. It's the same thing when we have a plea. There are often times when a plea is the best thing that can happen for a client. We can consult with that client and tell the client that client should take a plea, it should take X number of years. And that client says no, ends up going to trial, and gets four times as many. I know I have many clients like that. It happens all the time, but that's the client's choice. So, but even here, the attorney has the ability during trial to try and achieve that goal, even if it's unobtainable, but at the same time pursue what the attorney thinks is the best thing for the client, and that might be to try to get a lesser, but get a lesser not included.
Mr. Sandler, I tell you what I think is difficult. I mean, I think it's a very difficult issue. I think you're confusing what is the objective of the client and the means of getting it. What you're really saying is if in this case it would be different. The client said, I don't want you to do anything, present any defense whatsoever, except put the government to the proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But he didn't say that. He said, I want to be acquitted, but only on the basis of self-defense. And I think that's a totally different thing when you're talking about. That's the means by which the client obtains the objective, which is solely within the lawyer's province.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I don't disagree with that.
So here, it's perfectly okay for the lawyer to say to the client, we're not going to present self-defense because there really is no scintilla of evidence in this case of self-defense. It's unrealistic, it's unprofessional, and you'll be convicted. Right?
I don't have a problem with that either.
So what was really wrong here?
Well, what was
And wait a minute. And you're assuming that the facts are actually as stated in the opening statement. There are many, many cases which are decided on different bases based on the facts other than what the lawyers say in opening statements.
Of course. And we all know that fact, the opening statements aren't evidence.
Sure.
And especially in a trial like this, when weeks and weeks and weeks are going to pass, what a jury even focuses in on.
Well, it's not just juries. You know, human beings are frail, have frail perceptions.
Exactly.
Very few of us testify the same thing that we told people earlier and so forth, right?
But the problem remains that the attorney stood up in opening arguments and said, Mr. Berger committed a crime. Not in so many words, but said, Mr. Berger committed a crime. And you know what? I'm not going to ask that you find him not guilty all the way. I'm going to find that you only find him not guilty of these specific crimes. And if he testifies, you shouldn't believe a word he said because he's not credible.
Well,
I don't understand how that in and of itself doesn't create a conflict of interest between counsel.
Well, it may create a conflict of interest in one sense, but not a legal conflict of interest.
Well, I think it does create a legal
conflict. How does it create it? Because, I mean, basically, suppose the facts came out that it was self-defense. You'd argue self-defense and be acquitted, right? Even though the lawyer made an inconsistent statement, right?
I didn't catch that last part.
I'm sorry. Well, suppose the facts came out for self-defense, mm-hmm. right? And the client testifies to self-defense. He would be then acquitted. So there's no conflict, and he'd be a happy camper.
Well, but what we're presuming then is that Mr. Bergrud had counsel. He didn't have counsel here.
Now, Mr. Berger didn't want these lawyers, because he wanted to present this defense.
What he said is that if they go out there and they take back their opening statements, I'm fine. And that's all they had to do. If they go back there and take back their opening statements, I mean, maybe that's not feasible. But he never said, "I don't want these attorneys."
I've given many opening statements I wanted to take back, but never had it happen.
Haven't we all?
So you think the judge should have said, well, I'm sorry, they're not going to take back their opening statements, and they're your only lawyers, and you're stuck with them.
Am I saying that that's what should have happened?
Yeah.
No?
No, okay. You're...
What I'm saying is that a mistrial should have been declared, and you should have been given new counsel. But I don't think that's the right question. I think the question is, what should counsel have done a month prior, or 2 months prior, when it became clear that this conflict was out there, and counsel took no steps whatsoever. And at that point in time, counsel should have come to the court and said, we have these problems, we need to resolve it. Counsel should have filed a motion to withdraw.
And how should the court have resolved that at that point in time in your scenario?
In my scenario, the court had a couple of options available. The court could have told Mr. Bergerud that you don't have the right to necessarily choose self-defense, and should have told counsel, and obviously they wouldn't have known that because this court hasn't made that pronouncement yet, that in counsel, you cannot concede client's guilt in opening statements. And if counsel said, I don't want to do that, I want to withdraw, at that point in time, there's a conflict, and the court should appoint counsel.
Well, suppose the lawyer said, Judge, I'm not going to admit any of the lesser includeds, but I'm only going to talk about first degree and why he's not guilty of that. So therefore, I'm not pleading the client guilty, and I'm not throwing the client under the bus.
Well, with all due respect, the attorney is throwing the client under the bus because there are going to be lessers in this case introduced. That's not necessarily even the prosecutor has the right to introduce those lesser includes if the prosecutor so desires, and I'm assuming that in this case the prosecutor would, especially given the fact that a hung jury was resulted the first time around in first degree. So it is, in essence.
Yeah, we always get these petitions after convictions. We get them a lot of times, you know, from prisoners. No prisoner is ever satisfied that everything was done correctly. And no prisoner seems to be satisfied, unless they're acquitted, that their counsel was any good. So I'm wondering if you're arguing for a standard that isn't actually impossible for defense counsel to actually present cases when that second guessing, which we often see, is advanced to the front end of the case as the client sits there and isn't satisfied that it's going in his or her direction.
Well, I don't know how many of those cases this court has where the defendant's express wishes are known to either the court or to counsel. In this case, court is aware of the conflict. I think that if defendant is sitting there and this happens, and nothing is said to the court, nothing is said to counsel, then I think the horse is out of the barn. You know, I think that issue is gone. I think that if you look at Florida v. Nixon, it made it clear that the attorney had the obligation to consult with the client, which he did in Florida v. Nixon. The client didn't disagree, so there wasn't an express disavowance, but there wasn't an express okay. But when you have a situation, you know, one presumes that attorneys follow the ethical rules, and I think that they do, and consult with their attorneys about their clients about the objective of the representation. And if there's a conflict regarding the objective of the representation, then the attorney should go forward.
Yeah, but the way you framed it, this innocent-based defense, that's not really what this is all about, because juries don't find people innocent. They find that the prosecution hasn't proved its case for one reason or another. That's obviously what this counsel was trying to do, was it not?
Hasn't proved their case with regard to first-degree murder. That's all. So in that sense, I think if one wants to say not say guilty or not guilty-based defense, we can put it that way as well. But here, there's no way that Mr. Berger could have walked away with a not guilty verdict of all the charges. And that's what his objective was, however unrealistic it might be to obtain that objective. I think at least at the outset, the attorney can't deliberately subvert that objective, which is what happened here, by standing up in opening statements and saying, he's guilty of a crime, it's up to you to decide what crime he committed. And not only that, he's deluded, so don't listen to him. So we have a direct subversion of what the objectives are at the outset of the case. And I think that's where we are. And once the evidence comes in and the cards fall where they may, then I think the attorney has an obligation, quite frankly, to try to make the best of what happened at trial, what actually happened at trial, and what actual evidence there is, and what the jury must decide. And at that point in time, you can just say, well, you should find him not guilty, and you should find him not guilty. But if you don't find him not guilty of all the crimes, then perhaps he's only guilty of second-degree murder, or perhaps he's only guilty of manslaughter. But once in the outset, when you subvert that objective at the beginning, I think that steps over the line. And so, I think it's an easy, bright-line rule to make.
And so, as I understand, in terms of the remedy then, you base your argument for a reversal here on the grounds that the opening statement in and of itself mandated a mistrial, and when the judge refused to grant that, that was reversible error.
Well, what I'm saying is that it created an irreconcilable conflict of interest between Mr. Berger and his attorney. And at that point in time, there was the only option available at that point in time was to declare a mistrial and appoint new counsel for Mr. Berger. Instead, what happened here, the trial court said, well, you can go forward with conflicted counsel, or you can go forward by yourself. And under those circumstances, I think he's put between, he made impermissible choices, and I think what we have is a violation of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, either counsel as a whole or right to conflict-free counsel.
Okay, thank you.
And it appears that I'm out of time. Thank you.
What we're dealing with in this particular case is whether the language the Court of Appeals used in deciding this case and the way it was presented to the Court of Appeals was correct or not. I think we're going off on different situations here. And I don't often express sympathy with the task of criminal defense attorneys, and there's probably not enough witnesses here who would believe I would ever express it. But what is a criminal defense attorney supposed to do in a case like this, where his counsel wants, where his client is directing him to present defense that he knows is crazy? What if the defense had said a true innocence-based defense would be a defensive alibi? I wasn't even here. And what if the defendant in this particular case, my attorneys won't present an alibi defense on my behalf? That's a true innocence-based defense. Is counsel required to present something like that?
Well, slow down a minute now. It seems to me that this was a very good point that was made over here. My counsel is delusional. He didn't know what he was doing. He was wandering around in a fog. You know, whatever it was, there was no evidence of that. Didn't she step over the line there when she questioned his competence? We know from the facts probably that he was fully competent and plotted this, right? Now, he became maybe delusional later on about what would be successful trial, right? But she did make some kind of statement that was... Sorry. That was over the line, right?
We've got a factual discussion, which I'm not even sure. I'm not sure what, we don't have any record of what the defense attorneys that were going to represent and whose representation were short-circuited by the issue here, what evidence they were going to present as far as the defendant's mental level and stuff like that. We do have the record of the first trial. I don't recall whether he had been examined by psychologists, given IQ tests, determined his level of competency. I think what the court needs to do here is it needs to present a clear test that defense attorneys and trial courts can follow. What I've heard so far is just so confusing. I don't know what a defense attorney could possibly do. How do you distinguish between innocence-based defenses on some technical defenses and not on others? I don't think a defense attorney would know what to do. And if this court were to hold that defense attorney must present self-defense if his client so directs, I think that controls the entire course of what defense counsel does throughout that trial. Can he present the testimony of psychologists saying the defendant is at borderline levels of intelligence, or can he present evidence that the defendant was intoxicated or had cocaine in his blood system? If the defendant is allowed to tell a defense attorney what technical defense to present, that controls the whole course of the trial and subjects the defense attorney to ineffectiveness claims, and also renders the judgment incredibly suspect for post-conviction review. So I have to go. Thank you.
I want to thank both counsel on behalf of the court. Court will be in recess. The students, you're asked to remain in your